Hello, dear internet strangers. Today is Saturday, April 30th, and we are talking in obscurity. Today we're talking about The Sandman by Neil Gaiman and Dirk Maggs, and I'm joined by my co-host
Steve Kubitz,
and I'm Kevin Carlson. So how are you feeling today, Steve?
You know, feeling good. I just to get it out of the way, I love this. This is like, we always talk about how we listen to things on Audible, and we always have to sort of like excuse that with people. Like, it's always, well, we listened to this on Audible, we didn't really read the real book. And I can feel the judgment from everyone out there. Well, I like real books, I like the way they smell. Well, this one, you have no choice but to have Audible, because it's an Audible original.
Yeah, let's dive into what we love about this, and I'm going to steal what you were alluding to. I love the fact that this is a radio drama. This is I feel like this is a really good introduction into that format of how a radio drama works.
Yeah, so, you know, the same thing is, I love radio dramas. Like I said, I own, as I've said before, my day job is radio. Mm-hmm. That's what I do for a living, and I love radio dramas. I own probably like 24 cassette tapes, maybe more vinyl of old school radio dramas, and you know, I love that format. I've always loved that. I've always been very attached to that format.
Like, The Lone Ranger,
Green Hornet. There's a lot of really good sort of, you know, that old school sort of idea. My favorite Superman. There's a lot of great Superman radio dramas out there.
Oh, I didn't realize.
Oh, that. Absolutely. Yeah. The greatest example of it is Superman Fights the KKK. So you might not know this about American history, but we used to have a problem with racism.
Wow.
I know. What? Used to. It's over now. But
did we ever fight a war about it?
A little bit, but one of the biggest problems in the 1930s, or I believe I want to say, but it was pre-World War II.
Hmm.
The Klan had a huge uptick in membership. Oh yeah, I know. And so the people that made Superman decided, okay, we'll lease out the character, even though at this point just a comic book character, you know, Action Comics, to do radio serials where he fights and beats up the Klan and shows them how stupid they are. And what's amazing about it was, this is true, you can look this up, after these serials aired, these were specials, it wasn't like a full weekly series,
yeah.
It was a special, Klan membership, that actually they saw numbers that it... It went way down.
That is a fascinating bit of Americana.
Yeah, and
I'd never known. I am so going to look into this later.
It's a cool thing. And there's actually a comic based on the radio serials that came out about a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago.
Yeah.
About Superman versus the KKK. Huh. And it's, one, it's an amazing comic book run, too. But if you have a chance, you can look them up on YouTube. Look up the old school radio serials of Superman versus the KKK.
I mean, that's really relevant to, like, how this is a DC comic. You can read the actual comic book of The Sandman. But, like, I prefer this because, like, I really love this format of how... how they tell stories in a different way, with like everything has to be done through dialogue and sound effects and music, and it isn't your traditional audiobook, because it is definitely taking that form of how like all these old radio dramas were done through the power of people's voices just on the radio. And how I was actually introduced to this format wasn't because I read, listened to The Lone Ranger or The Green Hornet, as you brought up. Stephen King's son, Joe Hill, had a radio drama. It's called Lock and Key. And it like, was advertised on Audible at one point. I got it for free just to try it. And like, it's an amazing series. I think it's a Netflix show, too, now.
Like The Sandman.
Yeah. Well, The Sandman's going to become one. That's not out yet.
I don't think it's out yet. No.
Yeah. So another thing, diving more specifically into it. So if you don't know the characters in this, is that these characters are called the Endless, and they represent concepts like death and dream and envy and all that. And the Sandman is really about the Endless character called Dream. And of all of these different like immortal creatures that exist in this universe, I really liked how like James McAvoy and Kat Dennings depicted these characters.
Yeah, for me, like, some of the things we sort of like, without giving anything away yet, the actual sort of voice acting in it is incredible. I love Kat Dennings, and I love James McAvoy. I think they're both immensely talented actors that I pretty much anything they're in, I'll watch. Just because I like them. So, and not a lot, and it's fun, not a lot of great actors are good voice actors. There's plenty of real, there's a lot of examples of good actors that can't do voiceover work, or can't do voice work, because it's just not their thing. It's a very different kind of skill set. But these two, particularly, and there's plenty of good performances in this, but these are the two, so I would say, if I would wager, I guess, the most famous people in this are Kat Dennings and James McAvoy.
Well, my favorite audiobook narrator, Ray Porter.
And he's great.
He's famous to me.
Yeah, and he is absolutely, he's incredible. But he's an actual, honest to God, voice actor.
Yeah.
You know, but two people that are two just sort of regular old screen actors to do such a good job and sort of how to make their voice, to me, like, good voice acting, you can feel the emotion without them having to, like, say, like, I'm mad. And I think both, now, not Kat Dennings so much in this, because death is kind of, is more whimsical in this. She's much more of a...
She's more stable than Dream.
Yeah, because she's death. She's the most, like, finite concept there is.
Yeah.
But Dream, played by James McAvoy, Sandman, whatever you want to call him, there are times where you can just feel his anger. You can feel the rage within. And it is so well acted and so well voice acted by James McAvoy that if you're a person that doesn't like James McAvoy and you give this a listen, I really think you'll come to the other side.
Yeah, like, and that's the power of the radio drama format is, like, unlike in a traditional novel, how you'd read it is, like, they would have the dialogue and then it would end with, he said angrily. You don't have a he said angrily, or like you don't have that adjective just in there. You have it is there's no qualifier to any of this. It has to all be conveyed through how he says the line, because there's no exposition that narrates the scene. It's everything that is through how the characters are talking to each other and the sound effects, and like it's amazing how well. Whenever it's well written, that you fail to notice that, like, people don't normally describe everything that's happening in there. Like, Stephen and I don't sit here and go, and the room is blue as we discuss this podcast.
That would be a weird way to talk.
Yeah, I mean, the room is mostly blue. There's an accent wall to my left, Stephen's right.
You know what's weird is I've been... Because I only exist in this podcast. I'm not actually an entity.
Yeah, it's just me talking.
Yeah, I've never noticed that wall. Ever.
It's the fact that it is like a sharp accent.
Yeah, wow, I'm stupid.
You've never actually noticed that?
No, because let me describe this to you if we're a sitcom. The TV is to my left. So it's facing the other way. I would never face that way unless we're recording this podcast, and I don't look over there because I'm always so focused on how fucking funny I am.
That wall is my favorite part of this room, is the fact that it's a zigzag pattern of green and blue, and you've never noticed it.
No, never have. Yeah. Wow.
So let's get off paint.
Yeah. Speaking of things, other things I like about this. Again, I know if we're moving to any kind of spoiler bit, but I'll tell you this. The main meat of the story is insanely good.
Yeah.
And oh my god, like, every episode, because it's episodic, that deals with sort of the main plot, I was invested in. And, like, I'd be sitting there, like, I listen to this a lot of times on my lunchtime walks, because I take mental health walks, because, you know, I'm a millennial. And I would be walking, and there'd be times where I'd be, like, either in, like, at the north side or, you know, somewhere, and I would then realize that I've walked a half hour out of my way.
Yeah.
Because I was so into what was going on that I would cease to exist other than just walking straight listening to the story.
And I think most episodes are, like, a half an hour, so
yeah.
You'd get a half an hour out, and then you'd have another episode to listen on the way back.
And I usually did.
So, you know, it worked out. Do you want to move on to our dislikes at this point, or?
Yeah, it's...
So, like, building off your point, the main action, the main story, I think is phenomenal. I agree with you 100%. But My first dislike of it is that there are some episodes that seem to be, they're just odd tangents from the main action of the story. And then they become, like, filler episodes. And, like, I think at one point we discussed, like, because we both watch Dragon Ball Z from, like, we're that kind of, I wouldn't say we're anime nerds, but, like,
we, I'm definitely an anime nerd, but
like,
we've watched the main the big ones.
The big ones that, like, get pushed in America.
Dragon Ball Z, Yu Yu Hakusho, like, Inuyasha.
Yeah, like, so, it kind of felt, like, similar to that anime tradition of, not that this is an anime, it never was, but there will be an episode where, well, that was interesting.
Yeah, but
like, it doesn't really add anything to this.
The best way I can describe it is, for those that have watched Dragon Ball Z, it's the episode where Goku and Piccolo learn how to drive.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that both can fly.
No reason to drive.
There's no reason to drive. There's none. But they both learn to drive.
Yeah.
And it's funny. It's an amazingly funny, weird episode. But it doesn't add anything to the plot. You could remove that episode, and you often most... Actually, if you get most DVDs, that's not on there.
Because for some reason, if I remember correctly in the story, in Dragon Ball Z, Piccolo wears normal clothes when they go and get their license. Yeah. Which is just a fucking weird thing.
He's wearing like a hat. Like a backwards hat.
Yeah, it was...
Like he's not green.
Yeah, like if anybody was ever going to confuse him, like... Not to get too far off of the Sandman here, but like, that's what I like mean is like,
because there are absolutely episodes of this, but I guess we're not going kind of in the spoiler bit a little bit, right?
Yeah, the spoiler section's next. Well,
but I'll get into this a little bit. There's an episode that in this that is about cats.
Yeah,
and it's interesting. Yeah. I was very into it when I was listening to it, but I'm like, wow, if you remove this, nothing changes about the main plot.
Yeah, it doesn't add anything to the main arc of the story. Right. And there are more than one of those stories where, like, any person that writes anything, there's a small obsession with Shakespeare in this that has... It comes up more than once and has varying levels of relevancy to what's happening.
Yeah. And I think there's something to be said about, like, you know, when you do like episodes that sort of just that are world, sort of they're world building, which like I actually think that there's an example of this where it's about sort of him meeting this person over multiple times, over a lot of years. It doesn't add to the plot, but it's a good world builder.
Yeah,
and I think this does a lot of those filler episodes, even though you don't need them. A few of them shine because they're just sort of building the sort of this universe.
They're interesting in of themselves, and I get your point that, like, it's good world building, but, like, I've become more and more disenchanted with the idea of world building in general, because, like, I feel like authors get into this thing, like, well, I have to be a great world builder. Like, I mean, Tolkien was a great world builder, and Brandon Sanderson is a great world builder, and I have to do that, too. Not to say that Neil Gaiman needs to have that level of anything, but like I find that like sometimes focus is more important to me than the just because this episode is interesting. I think that a more streamlined approach is like I'd say that like maybe a third of these episodes are just because they thought this was fun but it didn't fit into the main concept.
Yeah, I could see that. I think that, like, overall, I can't remember how many episodes there are. I think, like, 13 or 14 or something like that. Mm. But regardless, you're probably right. It's probably, like, 9 or 10 of them are main plot. And then 5 of them, 4 of them are just sort of there. And there's some of them are interesting. Some are also kind of like, well, did you really need this? Like, I really feel like a lot of them are just kind of needless. And, like, that is not... And the thing is... I don't mean needless as they're boring, but like you said, needless in the fact that they don't add anything. And I think that like if you're going to do a story, because this story in itself, if you actually like streamline the plot and explain it in a way, it's a fascinating story. Because it's the concept of dreams, which what the Sandman is, mm-hmm. is a really fascinating concept,
mm-hmm.
especially the being the endless and... But I feel like you're right. It felt like they had a quota of episodes they needed to have. And they were, well, we kind of stretched out all we can stretch out of the main plot. What can we do? Some filler. It's fine.
Yeah, let's mind Shakespeare at this point. And, or the cat thing. Another thing that I felt that, personally, that, like, so this is a DC comic made into a radio drama for Audible. So it exists in that DC universe, but it feels oddly divorced from the main universe of, like, DC comics.
Yeah.
Where there are major characters, like the Martian Manhunter shows up at one point. And there are a couple other characters.
Dr. Crane from Batman.
Yeah, that's a good one, too. But they feel like bit players. They just show up to do things, and then they're gone. But, like, there are major world-shattering, earth-shattering events that take place in The Sandman that you would really think that, like, Superman and Batman and Wonder Woman would definitely show up.
That's, yeah.
And they don't.
That is a huge problem I had, because can we just get into a spoiler bit now a little bit?
Like, well, we're done with, do you have any more
notes? Yeah, no, I would say that's pretty much exactly my... Look,
let's jump in the spoilers.
Just, yeah, because that to me is the exact point I want to get into. So there's an episode in this that features, it's the Muse episode.
Yeah.
It's my second favorite episode of this entire thing. Mm-hmm. And in it, a character, this Muse character, is kidnapped and raped over and over again for inspiration. Whoever rapes this woman gets inspiration, whatever that is, writing, art, creativity, whatever. And she's crying out for help. And this is the DC Universe, and this is happening in modern day. So Superman can hear almost anything at any time. So I feel like Superman would show up to help this woman.
Yeah, at some point.
At some point. He would eventually get to it. And I find that, like, that, I agree, is if you're going to do in the universe that has Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, Green Lantern, Martian Manhunter, all these, the Justice League, them not showing up feels very glaring. It's kind of the same thing that I actually feel like, not related to this, but in this universe, that the show Peacemaker did brilliantly. Mm. Where the Justice League show up, but it's after the story, like, they show up late. Hmm. And it's played for kind of laughs. Hmm. And I like that. But this, they don't ever show up. You get Martian Manhunter a little bit, but he's just there to give Oreo cookies to people.
Yeah. I remember that thinking, like, his entire effect in that was to talk a bit, know who Dream was,
yeah,
and then give this other guy Oreos.
And it's just...
He didn't really have an effect on the story. And, like, to get into the episode with the 24-hour one where...
Which is both of our favorite, I think.
Yeah, it's all set in this diner, and this guy steals Dream's
power. It's not Dr. Crane. It's a pretty obscure Batman villain.
Yeah.
I cannot remember, but it's a fairly obscure Batman villain. It's like,
Because Scarecrow sees him out of Arkham.
Yeah.
Like, well, you'll be back, and he's like, I'll never be back, and then he's, of course, back. But... It's a 24-hour... It's basically 24 hours of this where this mortal has stolen Dream's powers from him and is creating a nightmare for all of Earth. And we are just seeing what's happening in this specific diner he's in. And the whole episode, it's getting worse because he has complete control over these people. And, like, he makes them do whatever he wants them to do. It goes predictably what you would think a sociopath would do to having full control over people as though they're puppets. It goes from, you know, sexy time to murder. And
back and forth.
Back and forth, yeah. Like, mutilation and all that. And the whole time I was thinking, okay, somebody's about to show up. Somebody's going to show up and, like, fix this, make this okay. They're going to stop this from happening, or they're going to make it better. Dream is going to come in at any moment.
At any point.
And no. Like, that confrontation does happen eventually, but, like, all of these poor people in this diner get murdered.
They all do. And it's Dr. Destiny.
Dr. Destiny.
That's who, yeah. And that's, yeah, that episode to me was, here's how much I like that episode. That I actually listened to it twice. Which is all it says about me as a person. But it was because it was so...
Like, compelling.
It was so compelling, and it was so riveting, and it was just so brutal. And it's what's funny, it kind of reminded me a little bit of, you guys, listeners out there, don't know this about me. I love fucked up foreign movies.
Yeah.
And one of the ones that I showed my friends, because I like them to suffer as much as I, is a movie called Salo, or 120 Days of Sodom. And in that movie, if you haven't seen it, don't, because it's disgusting. These characters do these kind of horrible acts, but they're very like whimsical about their like horrible acts.
Yeah.
And that's what this sort of story, this 24-hour one, reminded me of. This guy is like making these people do these horrible things, and he's just kind of doing it because it's fun to him, and he's laughing, and he's so like divorced from reality. And it's so brutal. Like, there's scenes where people are like having sex while they're being impaled, or one guy like chops his own arm off and is laughing while he's doing it.
Yeah.
And it's so disturbing. But the way the character of this sort of Dr. Destiny, as he's perceiving all these things, because it's all from his perspective, you kind of just almost feel like, how does this guy not get how horrible this is? And to predate this, before it even gets to the diner, it's the chapter is one of the longer chapters. I believe it's almost an hour.
Yeah.
Because it begins with him having this road trip adventure with this nurse he kidnaps.
And yeah, they have a whole connection.
They seem like they're really getting along, and she seems to actually like sympathize and get him. And I'm listening to this and going, this is so nice that he's sort of having this human moment with this. And then immediately when he's like, okay, bye, and he just kills her.
Yeah. I remember when he murdered her, I was like, oh.
But that tells you about this character in this beautiful way and how he feels about like other human beings. And it's this weird, I can't remember what the clinical term is, sociopath or psychopath, whatever it is, but he's so bemused by all of it. And as a listener, your instinct is to, you side with the person whose perspective on it. It's just our instinct. That's why like first person accounts are so effective as storytelling tools. So your instinct is to kind of sort of side with him and you feel bad for him. Then you realize he is so emotionally dead inside that all these things that are happening mean nothing to him. And it's so horrifying.
Yeah, I like the thing about that chapter that I like from a story perspective so much is that the population of people in the diner that he's torturing to death, that you are subjected to in this, and like, I know that's a weird thing to say that you like, is they're the full gamut of people. There are people that you're instantly sympathetic to. Like the woman who wants to be a writer and she has all these concepts.
The waitress.
Like the waitress. There are other people that are just kind of shitty. They're just kind of
shitty. The bad husband who cheats on his wife.
Yeah. I like the concept of like, it rains on the just and the unjust equally.
Which is kind of a thing that comes up in DC Comics a lot.
Yeah, I know it came up on The Watchmen.
I know before anyone out there goes, well, Watchmen was, it is a DC comic now. Dr. Manhattan exists in the DC universe. He's the god. It is a DC comic.
Yeah.
That's the whole crux of Watchmen. It rains on the just and unjust alike. And I think this does kind of the same thing, where the point of it is that whether you're good, bad, and different, all in between, bad things can happen to you.
Yeah.
That's part of it.
I like that. Well, I know we're in more, we're past likes and dislikes, but we're more, this is our analysis section here, but like, I like that concept of, it's, things happen, and sometimes they're completely out of your control, and like that, I think we've all felt in our lives, events, especially after the pandemic, that no matter what your plan was in life, something comes along and changes the entire course of your existence. I didn't anticipate spending 2020 mainly in this fucking room, Skyping Steve.
Yeah, I think that's such a... Wow, way to make it fit. Good for you. No, that's so true. I think like a lot of this story, from a thematic point of view, is that the crux of the story is about these people. They're endless. They're eternal. So you think it's going to be this sort of unreachable... Like, if you met God, you know, and you had this sort of immortal, endless being, you would think it'd be incomprehensible to our brain.
Yeah.
These endless in the story it does a really good job of sort of, they're humanized in the sense, like, you sort of get a little bit of their wants, their desires, their sort of, their intermingle fighting. But what's interesting is that even though these people are immortal, but as the mortals they interact with are given enough sort of air to breathe, that you sort of can relate to them. And it does a really powerful job of making sure that the one sort of example I'm thinking of is, there's a bit in the end of it where you meet this little boy who's kidnapped, and his sister's looking for him. And they spend multiple chapters making you love this woman.
Yeah. Because this is the serial story.
Yeah. You spend all these chapters loving, and she's looking for her little brother he's been missing for years.
Yeah.
And so you really come to sympathize with her, and she is a great character. And then you find out that, no, she needs to be killed because she's actually a vortex. And the Dream has basically he is this endless being that has no choice in it. He just is. And he basically says, I take no pleasure in him to kill you. But for a person that you're listening to the story, you feel so bad for her because you spent three or four chapters basically as she's trying to find her little brother.
And I think that's a great concept in storytelling, where you can't just show, and this is a limitation, I've said this many times before, of just people in general. You can't just show a sad thing happen to a character and go, isn't that so sad? Like, intellectually, yeah, it's sad. But people don't really empathize with people that they don't know. If we did, then there wouldn't be world hunger anymore. And maybe we should be more like that. From a storytelling perspective, the most effective story is you get to know people over a series of episodes and a series of stories. Doesn't matter how long or short they are, but it's that repetition of having multiple scenarios with this person that you get to know them, so that whenever something bad is about to happen to them, like in her case, where Dream has no choice because she's going to rip the fabric of Dream's for not just her or the immediate surrounding, but everybody, and that's going to kill
everyone.
She has to go away or to stop this cataclysm. It's profoundly sad for you because you've got to know her. You know who she is and what her goals were, what her dreams were, what she liked and disliked, and what she was like as a person. And whenever you know so much about a person, at a certain point, I feel like if you're somebody that can feel empathy, once you get to know somebody, no matter, even if you disagree with them, whenever they are faced with their mortality, it almost automatically causes you to feel bad about the end of that character. And the fact that she's so likable anyways is such a knife in the guts kind of feeling whenever you know that the main character is going to have to kill this woman to save everybody else.
And it's also, which is cool, because the thing this story does so well is it's funny, there's a lot of filler, but there's also things that play off. One of the people you meet early on is this little girl that is 6 years old and goes into a coma for 70 years.
Yeah, that's her mother.
And that's, no, it's her grandmother. No,
grandmother. Yeah, you're right.
And because because the story doesn't pull punches, how this woman had kids, because I'm sure you can figure out how this woman had kids while she was in a coma for, it ain't great.
If you ever seen Kill Bill, you understand.
Yeah. But then this grandmother, as she's, even though she's intellectually 15 years old, basically, is dying, and she basically crosses over into the dream board and goes, no, it should be me. I should be the one that is the vortex. It's not my granddaughter. Take me instead. Mm-hmm. And it's this beautiful sacrifice that has weight to it, because, again, you feel for this woman because you know that she was robbed of her entire life.
You but you were introduced to her early on.
Way early in the story.
And then, like, she when she wakes up from her coma, much later
because
on.
Because Dream is, because the spoiler, without giving too much recapping of this, Dream is kidnapped.
Yeah, we're in the spoilers.
Yeah. I don't want to because that's, you know, it's, but Dream's kidnapped and he's held in a prison basically for years, decades. Mm-hmm. But while he's doing that, people either can never sleep again, or they just never wake up.
Yeah.
And this woman, this girl, she's a child, never wakes up. And she's just, it exists sleeping. But then finally, when Dream escapes, she wakes up. And at this point, she realizes that now she's in her, like, 40s. And she spends basically the remaining of her golden years trying to find that daughter that she knows she never knew she had.
Yeah.
And it's a really cool sort of bit where then, after she's reintroduced, and you sort of get to see a little bit of her interacting with her granddaughter and daughter. And it's really nice, and it's really sweet. And then the daughter character, immediately, or the granddaughter character, basically goes, okay, I have to go. There's one more person missing. We have to find my brother.
Yeah.
And that's where the bulk of her adventure is. But then you think, oh, I guess that's interesting that she's related to this person. I'm sure it's not going to come up again. But it does. And it's a brilliant sort of comeback where she goes, listen, I'm the one that should be the vortex. It should have been me. But I was robbed of that opportunity because I was put into basically a coma for 70 years or whatever it was, 40 years. Mm. And it's perfect how it works out because even Dream's like, yeah, that makes sense. And she basically absorbs her granddaughter's whatever vortex powers would be.
Mm.
And her granddaughter's allowed to live because of that sacrifice. And think of the power of that. They only just met. And after only meeting for maybe a couple of days,
yeah,
the woman, the girl, goes off to America. This woman's in England. She goes back to America to find her little brother. So this is a beautiful sort of sacrifice for a person that, you think about kids, because this woman is mentally 15 years old,
still,
basically.
Still young, because like she missed most of her life. Yeah.
But she still has that sort of power, that love, to go, no, this isn't right. I'm going to sacrifice myself for my grant, for my blood.
Because she's at that point, she's much older, too.
She's dying.
She's an old lady that's dying of old age. But, like, my last point that I want to bring up in this section of just in analyzing the story is that it's a pretty uneven experience. This the whole collection of episodes, you never know what the next one's going to be like. Is it going to be whimsical? Is it going to be the main story arc, or is it going to be a random thing? Because there's a few of those random.
They're sprinkled out throughout. It's not like here's the main story and then here's a bunch of like five filler episodes. They're all sprinkled out throughout the entire.
Like for when you're reading a book, you can kind of like get an even flow. You even whenever there are dramatic twists and turns or whatever, everything sort of like has this arc to it that makes sense. In The Sandman, you can have an episode that's main action, main action, main action. Oh, and now we're going to talk about cats.
And the whole point of view is from the point of view of cats.
Yeah, and it was interesting, the cats episode. And another episode that I really liked is there's this obscure DC character called, I believe her name is Element Girl.
Element Girl, yeah.
And Neil Gaiman wrote a story that is comic about this, is that her life is a living hell. And
yes, it is.
She, as a hero, she's cool and everything, but like her day-to-day existence is a living nightmare. And her closest interaction is with this guy, this analyst at the FBI or the NSA or whatever. And then he just doesn't want to deal with her anymore. And that was like her closest
friend. Her actual closest friend, quote unquote.
Wasn't quite a friend or whatever. And it was another episode where Kat Dennings shows up as Death. And love that episode because I loved how she portrayed Death. Like, she's always very comforting as you're talking to her. You're going to die at the end of it, but, like, she's very comforting.
Why wouldn't Death be comforting?
Sure. I don't even know if the Sandman is in
that episode. I don't think he is at all. Yeah, I actually think it's from the episode he's not in.
Like, I don't remember him even being in that episode. So, like, it's really an odd experience to be, like, having all of these episodes that are main action, main action, main action. Oh, and, oh, by the way, Element Girl's life is a living nightmare. And Dream's sibling, Death, has this whole thing with her. And it's profound in its own way. It would have worked great as a short story.
Yeah.
Like, as part of this collection, it feels uneven.
I think that's the overall, I would say, big flaw of this. Because if you look at it as, like, a season of, like, a show, it would be like if you were watching a TV show on Netflix or whatever, and how randomly sprinkled throughout, there'd be episodes that made no sense to the main story. Because as a TV viewer, you're not conditioned to really... In the world of streaming, we don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
That used to be the way... Honestly, filler TV episodes used to be the most... They used to be called bottle episodes. Okay, we'll do something cheap, we can fill out, we'll stretch it out, no big deal, no one will care. But now in the era of 12 episodes...
Things are a lot more focused now.
You don't do that anymore. And I think... So I think that's a little bit of what the... In a weird way, it is kind of a throwback. Where, okay, we did four episodes of main plot. Here's an episode of... Remember Death? You met her a couple episodes back? What she's doing in between meeting her brother.
Yeah.
Dream. And it's interesting. And I do completely agree with you that it does... As a listener, in this case, it does build a very uneven story. And it does build a very sort of like, you don't know what you're getting. And I think that's tough because if you're listening to, like, if you're reading Game of Thrones, you know it's going to be heavy. You know people are going to die. It's going to be brutal. If you're reading Lord of the Rings, you kind of know it's going to be this sort of big, huge, fantastical world where trees talk and songs are way longer than they need to be.
Like, he writes that all.
Yeah. But you know that, you kind of know going in, that's what it is. And that's fine. You accept that because that's what the world is. This is, if in one episode it was this sort of Death interacting and playing with little kids playing stickball in the street in this, like, funny little, like, haha. And then the next episode begins with this woman being brutally raped by an author that then goes, you know, I actually consider myself a feminist author.
Yeah. The juxtaposition in this is extreme.
And it that, to me, is, in a weird way, it's disarming. Because then you don't know what to expect. So if you don't know what to expect, then you're going to always be sort of...
It's never boring.
And I think there's something to be said about that. But I agree that if you're a person trying to sort of... Because the way this is presented, because I believe, like, not that long ago, maybe a couple weeks ago, maybe a month ago, the second, quote-unquote, season came out of this.
Yeah, I think it was a couple months at this point.
Yeah, maybe. But it just came out, relatively recently came out. So if you're looking at it as, like, a season, it'd be like, wow, why are there episodes that are so focused and then other episodes that are just, like, not focused, but there's episodes that are really, like, light and kind of funny and cute, and episodes where a character is, like, brutally, savagely, repeatedly raped, and you're like, wait, how? You just had an episode about cats.
Yeah, like, I think this is why this is so jarring is, not that that's bad or good, but it's so jarring because, like, imagine if your sitcom that you happen to like, How I Met Your Mother or Friends or whatever generation you are, decided to change genres between episodes, went from, like, just being, this is a situation comedy, and then the next episode is, this is a zombie apocalypse. And then went back to being a situation comedy. It would be shocking.
You know what's funny about that, though? Do you remember the show Boy Meets World?
Yes.
So, randomly, in the middle of that show, there, with a guest star from Jennifer Love Hewitt, there's an episode that is just randomly a slasher film. And the characters are killed off. Characters die and stuff. It's a dream. And then you read, Dan, it's a dream. It's just Sean's dream. Spoilers if you haven't seen this 22-year-old show. But that show did that. And people were so, what? Because it's a TGI Friday show. It's a cute little kid show. You know? And most of it is just like, I like Topanga and she doesn't like me back, or I like her but now we're not dating anymore. And then randomly, here's basically a loose Scream sort of version where all the characters you love are brutally murdered. Eric is pushed down an elevator shaft. Corey has his like is like stabbed in the heart, like, or stuff like that. And that show did it. It was very like, what? I remember being like a teenager when that came out. I was probably like 12, 13 years old, and being so confused, but so as a horror fan, being like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
And it's like, funny because now that episode is considered one of the best of the series.
Yeah, I mean, and maybe with a little distance, that happens with this. Yeah. By the way, did not know that about that show. Mm. I've known that show, and not to get too off topic, but like this is a firm disconnect between the two of us. Yeah. But I've never liked shows like Boy Meets World or The Wonder Years. Or
oh yeah, yeah.
Any of that because like
the coming of age shows.
Coming of age shows because. Like the message of those shows are, look at the standard family nuclear family American life, and isn't this wonderful? Like, so I had a standard nuclear family. It was fairly stable through my childhood, so I didn't really need stories that like kind of just weren't my day to day existence.
I didn't have a standard nuclear family. I thrived on having that regular bit. I'm like, this is nice.
Yeah. And, like, I get why you and other of our friends that also have experiences like you love those shows. And, like, I always felt bad whenever, you know, oh, I loved Boy Meets World. I was like, I always turn that off. Because, like, I didn't need somebody to remind me about my Tuesday. Because, like, I had those normal nuclear family problems.
Aren't you just perfect? Yeah. No, I agree. I think that's sort of like, well, to get back to this, why I sort of understand maybe they try to jump from like sort of whimsical to then horrifying. Because I think it's a great way. It's funny because it was definitely you sort of look at that more as more of a negative. Mm-hmm. I kind of think I look at it more as a positive, where I think it's sort of.
I think that's fair to say.
It keeps it, as a viewer, or in this case a listener, I think what it does is, it keeps you off balance. And I think one of the greatest examples of, like, the way to be scared in a horror film, for example, is to make sure you can't get a rhythm. So, like, jump scares in horror movies mm-hmm. don't work if you can sort of guess where they're coming from. And most, like, bad horror films are because you can sort of guess, like, okay, this is going to be
the killer's going to jump out of the wall.
No, who cares? But if you're... The best example I have would be in... The Conjuring movies. Yeah. There's a scene in the first Conjuring movie where it's all from the character of Patrick Wilson's wandering through this sort of, he's crawling through, and you think in your head, of course, when he crumbs through and he comes out, the monster's going to be right there. Mm. And it's real tense, and he's struggling, and you think, monster's jumping anytime now. Monster never jumps out. Mm. And you're just sort of left, okay, that's weird. But then immediately in the next scene, when it looks like it's the come-down scene, then it goes haywire. And if you're watching that, it throws you off. And it makes you much more unsettled because you're like, oh my god, I thought it was... Because it's really easy to be not scared when you sort of guess the rhythm of a horrifying scene.
Yeah.
And the example in this is the 24-hour episode in the diner.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you keep, like you said, you keep waiting for the hero because the hero's showing up. Don't worry, the hero's showing up.
Superman, somebody's going to stop this.
And what makes it horrifying is that it never comes. The hero does show up after it's all done.
Yeah, like everybody's dead already. And like Sandman does fix this. Yeah. Well, doesn't fix it for them, but like...
He fixes it for everyone else. But that is what makes it to me so brilliant, is that it does throw you off. It does make it so that you can never get in a comfortable rhythm of this. Mm-hmm. And for a radio serial, like this is... I would say the best way to listen to this, honestly, is take a break between every couple chapters.
Yeah.
Because I think it does a great job of making you sort of uncomfortable. And I think that it's super effective as a sort of a story of making sure that you're never in a rut with any of this. Mm-hmm. Because when you think you get it, all of a sudden here's an episode about cats. Or when you think you get it, Oh, okay. Here's an episode that is death murdering a stand-up comedian. But or not murdering. Death.
He doesn't murder.
Murder is the wrong word. Death has to go because a stand-up comedian dies on stage. And not in the stand-up comedian sense where you die alive on stage when you suck. She literally died on stage.
Yeah, it was a poorly grounded like microphone
and
or something.
So you never, as a listener, you never get a chance to sort of get comfortable and settled because it's constantly changing what it is. And I think that's a really effective storytelling method.
Well, before we get to our parting thoughts, I just want to bring up that my other favorite like story arc, where we were talking about that one character, you get to know a whole lot through her grandmother. The serial convention is, like, we're firmly in the spoiler section, by the way. Again, spoilers. So there's this convention at this hotel that character ends up at, that hotel, where they're having a serial convention. And I just did finger quotes, by the way.
Quote, unquote.
Quote, unquote. And you think, okay, what is a serial convention? Well, it's a convention for serial killers, not serial like the cereal. And the whole setup going into and during and after is just amazing. And the monster that is causing all of these people to be serial killers, that Dream sort of created, is a nightmare, is amazing. And, like, I love that whole chapter almost as much as the 24-hour one is.
Yeah, well. It is one of the chapters. There's a lot of chapters. They're all pretty good. You could listen to any one of these and be happy and entertained. Some really stand out. And I think the serial convention one, 24-hour one, really stick out. And the Muse one really sticks out.
The one in Hell?
The one in Hell, really. Yeah, there's a lot of really good chapters.
Which you'd think would be a heavy one, the Hell chapter. The Hell one. It's more of a whimsical one.
The Hell one, I would argue, is if you've listened to The Devil Went Down to Georgia, that's literally what this kind of is. It's Dream going, okay, I want my stuff back. And the devil's like, all right, we'll do a competition.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful. It's brilliant. And the fact that Dream wins. And the chapter literally ends with the devil going, one day I'm going to kill that man. And I love that. And that's why I think this is such a good, just amazing listen. It's because you can get a very different experience based on whatever chapter you're listening to. And I think that's cool. Everyone knows when you're watching Star Trek what Star Trek's going to be.
Yeah.
When you're watching a Star Wars movie, you know it's what it's going to be based on, you know, Star Wars. And this is cool because it's Neil Gaiman and Dirk Maggs. It's so varied. And it's so, it jumps genres and it jumps sort of, it basically doesn't give two shits what its genre is. And I think that's what makes Neil Gaiman so effective. Like American Gods is a great example of that, where he does not give two shits what you think this story is going to be about and what you think the story, where it fits.
That is definitely a story we should talk about that at some point in the future.
Yeah.
Because and that's kind of like Neil Gaiman's trademark is that it's hard to classify what he is as a writer because I've talked about earlier in this episode, Stephen King and his son, they write horror stories.
Yeah.
Sometimes they write things outside of their genre, but you consider them horror writers. And sometimes people will classify Neil Gaiman as a horror story writer, but then sometimes people will classify him as a fantasy writer or a science fiction writer.
Yeah.
All of those descriptors are true about him, but his stories tend to be cross-genre. There are chapters, and not just in this, but in his other books that he's written, like Neverwhere and American Gods or Anansi Boys. There are chapters that are fantasy-based and that are just straight up horror. He really transcends any sort of genre.
And I think that is what makes him so good. Because, yeah. Neil Gaiman is a writer. I think this is definitely the sort of the logical sort of closing point of this, is that he is so multi-talented and so multifaceted that it's almost kind of insane. Some people struggle to be really good at one thing. And he finds a way to be really good at a lot of different things. And not only is he good at things that should not be able to be related, and he makes it work. Not, again, back to this. This is a story that at its core is about Dream trying to reclaim his sort of legacy and reclaim his sort of domain.
Yeah.
Because he was kidnapped for, I think it was 60 years.
Yeah, some decades.
Decades. But in that story, there is, like I said, an episode about how everyone sees death, everyone sees Dream differently. How you perceive Dream is very different. That's why in the cat episode that we sort of, kind of, I don't want to scoff at it, you meet him. You meet Dream as a cat, because yeah. That's how cats see him. There's an episode about this sort of African tribe talking about the Dream Realm and how this woman, this queen of theirs, gave up her sort of mortality to be with Dream. And Dream is this dark-skinned African sort of warlord-looking guy. They're in the same story, but they're so different. But the beginning is they all sort of fit, even though they're so dramatically different. It's kind of like, the best way to describe it would be collecting baseball cards. Baseball players all look very different. Mm-hmm. But when you collect, you get the collection as a whole, it becomes its own sort of thing. And yeah. That's what the story kind of is. A collection of these very different elements that somehow shouldn't work. It's like jazz fusion. It shouldn't work, but it does.
Yeah. And I think that's a good point to jump off into our parting thoughts about, like, the thing that I want to bring up is that, like, it's rare that long-lived and immortal beings depicted in fiction are done well. With Dream, I love the, like, how the observer changes how he looks. And I like, we talked earlier about how he is, feels authentically like a creature that has no expiration date. And, like, he is, time is very, very relative to him, unlike our experience, where, because at the beginning of this, whenever he's kidnapped, his strategy to defeat them isn't to rage and use his mystical powers or anything. He just decides to wait them out. Like, he stays in the cage, and he's like, these people are eventually just going to die. And then they do.
And he escapes.
And he escapes, and it works out, because, like, basically, he just waits them out. And I feel like in fiction, it's rare that, like, I'm convinced by long-lived creatures. They just seem often either one of two extremes. Either they're too much like us and they're too relatable to the point where, like, if you lived for thousands of years, you wouldn't be concerned with this kind of daily grind. Versus the other spectrum is that they're so incomprehensible that you can't relate to them and they're therefore uninteresting. If you can't relate to a character as your primary character, then they're totally uninteresting.
Yeah, I think that, like, for me, like, in this, the best example I can think of is vampires.
Yeah.
I often find vampire stories super boring. Like, no offense to anyone who likes vampires out there, that's fine. I'm not against vampires. But a lot of vampire stories fall into this sort of realm of, look at these ancient creatures that, even though they exist, it's fucking 2022 and they're still acting like 1874.
Yeah, Interview with the Vampires like that. Yeah. Where they tend to, like, never progress. They're like, well, we were born in the 1800s, so we just kind of act like that forever.
And, like, that to me is, like, no offense, it's boring. Mm-hmm. And I like the fact that, you know, Dream and Death and Despair and Desire, they're ageless creatures. But guess what? Despite that, they're always of the time they are in. There's the chapter where Dream meets this man that says, I'm not dying.
Yeah.
And he doesn't. They meet every 100 years for, I believe, like 500 or 600 years.
Yeah.
And
they become friends.
They become friends. Every time they meet, Dream's a little different. And so is the guy. But Dream is immortal. So time means literally nothing to him.
Yeah, I love that balance of being able to make Dream seem like an ageless creature, but also somebody that evolves with the times. Where, like, the converse of, speaking of vampires, is, like, sometimes vampires, like, they're befuddled by cell phones. But they've not been dead for any of this time. They would have been able to keep up with the times. But the other extreme is, like, if you go into Twilight, which is not one of my favorite vampire stories. How long is this guy gonna like continue to go to high school? He's 100 years old.
Like, he's like Johnny Depp dating.
Like, he continues to go. How many times has he taken AP Bio? Like, at this point.
And why is he not an A student? Like, at this point, like, okay, so yeah, you're 107 years old, and somehow you're getting a C minus? Dude, walk into the sun. Because clearly, it ain't working for you.
Yeah, we discussed that with, like, how if you're a vampire that, like, isn't rich, like,
end your life.
Unless you're only, like, 30 years old as a vampire, you should have your shit together at this
point. At this point, yeah. For God's sake, I'm 35, almost 35, and I have a good stock portfolio at this point. If you're a vampire and you're ageless, and you can't get your shit together to make money in the stock market, just die. Either stake yourself or just walk. Go to Florida.
It's time to, like, really consider... What are you doing wrong? Because it's not the world at that point.
It's you. It's a you problem.
If you've been here for 200 years and you're still, like, just can't figure out how to maybe get ahead, what are you doing?
Just have a high-yield savings account.
Yeah, I mean, you don't, like, just, you can't die from, like, starvation. It'll be uncomfortable for you, but you're immortal.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, I think that's not, that is so funny. Like, there's so much of, like, this book does well. Is it makes immortal characters seem interesting. And that is so difficult to pull off because...
What are you even long-lived characters or ten are
hard to do? Yeah, we talked about like Methuselah in the Bible.
Yeah.
Is this character that lived to be, what, 900 years old, whatever it was, 1,000 years, whatever it was. He was old. And what doesn't mean anything that he's old. It's just, okay, here's an old character. And to be honest with you, I'm not convinced that most characters in the Bible, they said he lived to be 800 years old, wasn't just people looking down after the guy died and going, gray hair, 700 years old.
Yeah, he was like 600 years
old. That seems about right to me. He saw the sun rise a bunch, so I mean, he's got to be 600 years old.
Did they actually live 600 years, or did we just keep worse calendars?
Yeah, like that, yeah.
Because there's a lot of, like, if we're going to go all the way back to the original literature of, like, the Bible and the Torah and everything like that, is that, like, whenever you go into the Old Testament, everybody, like, Noah and Moses and the rest of them, they live very long lives, but they don't seem like people that have been around for centuries.
No, they just seem like they were characters that lived and then they died. But they also were old and they died. It wasn't like, they were 700 years old and they died. Like, that's cool, I guess.
Yeah.
That's nice for you.
But, like, that translates into fiction. Like, there are a lot of times where I said it with the tactic that Sandman used, where he just waited them out. Like, if you go back to Dracula, there are a few times where Dracula could have just been like, because he does try to flee at the end to avoid the vampire hunters, but he had to have known that there was a guy named Van Helsing on his trail way before. And Van Helsing wasn't a young man. He could have just like, oh shit, I'm just going to wait like 10 years and this guy's going to die of old age. And then I rule London.
Yeah, I think that's, yeah. That's what this, I think, story, to sort of wrap it up to me, is that, like, it does an amazing job of taking characters that are immortal that should be kind of boring because they're immortal, but giving them interest because they have familial rivalries and they have, you can relate to that because a person that I don't get along with my sibling, I'm sure everyone, there are plenty of people out there don't get along with their siblings. And not only that, but under the context, they don't just get along because they're siblings, they're also entities that hate each other because they're competing for the, they're sort of, how they view mortals is different.
Yeah.
Dream looks at mortals as a necessary part because mortals need to exist to dream.
It's a combination of the alien and the familiar mixed together, whereas a lot of times, like, I find in fiction, like, it either goes too alien or too familiar. It's rare to see a good combination of those two concepts.
And I think this really does a fabulous job of sort of, that's sort of the really overarching thing, is it relates the familiar with the alien, and it does an amazing job of marrying those concepts as a sort of fictional narrative.
Yeah.
And I think that's just, that's what makes this beautiful.
Well, I think we're, that's where we're
yeah.
gonna finish up here, and it's my pick.
Wait, what's your pick, pal?
I think I'm gonna go with War and Peace.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
All right, I'm just fucking with you. We're gonna actually go with Who Goes There?
Which is a story
by John W. Campbell. And it's a story that inspires John Carpenter's The Thing and also the other The Thing and...
All the other things.
All the other things.
I also like how you went from War and Peace, which is a 47-hour epic, to this short story, which is like 2 hours.
Yeah, I wanted to make you sweat that next month you're going to have to read a...
Like, just the longest...
Just a doorstop.
The Russian novel... I'm actually refusing because it's a Russian novel, so I refuse to read War and Peace out of
principle. Because of the current Ukrainian conflict. You're right. But yeah, we're going to go with Who Goes There, and it's a short novella. And The Thing, by the way, is my favorite horror movie.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading it. I think it's going to be fun, and it's going to be good to be back and talk about some, you know, because we always talk about such feel-good things on this podcast. So, you know, it's nice to get back to horror.
Yeah, we're going to go firmly into horror, and we're going to stick with fiction here. We'll get back to nonfiction at some point, I'm sure. All right, well, we hope you join us next month in May.